89.9 FM.
Oh, wow. And they broadcast all this from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people?
Find out for yourself Monday mornings at 11, or find episodes online at citr.ca.
Today we're joined in the studio by the Cedar Program Youth.
Where you at?
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. This is UBC Happy Hour, a show that is all about what's happening on UBC's campus, produced by the UBC Affairs Collective. I'm Lelaine.
I'm Julia.
I'm Catherine.
I'm Amy.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Sadie.
Yeah, and on this week's episode, we are talking about AMS elections, which are happening now. So voting opens up this Monday and closes next Friday, March 9th. It's been a big campaign week for all of the students here on campus. So we are joined in studio by the presidential candidates. So there are multiple positions that are being run for in these elections. So there's four VP positions, there's the Senate positions, and then there's also the president position. So the president is currently Alan Aaron Holes, the candidacy for president is running for now. So we're joined by Andy Lynn, Rodney Little Mustache, and Miriam Hamid, who are all running. Thank you guys for joining us in studio.
Thank you.
Why don't you guys start by introducing yourselves and what experience you guys have? So Miriam, do you want to start us off?
Absolutely. Hi, everybody. I'm Miriam. I'm super excited to be here. I'm running for the position of president. Fun fact about me, I was a resident advisor for 3 years at UBC, which means I have lived in almost every single first year residence UBC has. I was also the student services manager for the AMS this year. If you know what SafeWalk is or what the food bank is, I was one of the people who was able to get it to you. I really look forward to engaging with all of you further as we go on. Thank you for being here.
Nice. Thank you. Andy, do you want to go?
Okay. Hi, my name is Andy. I was born with arthroriposis, but now I'm a student at UBC. I'm taking business and computer science. In my spare time, I like to do athletics. I'm a high-performance paranordic athlete. And I'm running for president because I'm a Christian and I'm committed to Christ, and I want to bring that Christian vision to UBC through the AMS. And I believe it will solve issues on campus.
Thank you.
Okay, next question, Mr. Awastan. I am Rodney Little Mustache, I'm from, that's kind of close. Scary. No, anyway, I'm from originally from the Niitsitapi Confederacy, which is the Blackfoot Confederacy in southern Alberta. I'm from the Piikani Nation, and my name is Rodney Little Mustache. I'm running for this position as president, and my history is kind of long, like 17 years. And like from 1999 to 2003, I was on the BC, Healing Our Spirit BC Society for People Living with HIV and AIDS Aboriginal BC. Oh no, it's called Healing Our Spirit BC Aboriginal HIV AIDS Society. And after that, I was on the Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network from 2002 to 2004. The Five Fine Day Family Shelter Society from 2005-2006. Circle of Eagles 2007-2008. Public Health Agency of Canada, which was NACHA, the National Aboriginal Council on HIV AIDS. And Indigenous Students Committee here at UBC, and their University and External Government Relations Committee here at UBC. That's my history.
Thank you.
Yesterday, Alex and I, we went out and we did a streeter, which means we talked to a bunch of UBC students, and we got some questions from them and kind of just felt out student opinion on the elections so far. So we're going to play one of those questions now.
Yeah, and then ask you guys to answer the question. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like stores and stuff staying open for longer. I feel like they shut too early. And they're actually closing the weekends as well.
And more like fun events. Like how in Jomstar, like AMS had like stuff every week. So like maybe something like now, they have like something like fun every week, I guess. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, Okay, sorry. So that first question might have been a little bit obscured by the wasn't turned on correctly. But so basically those students were asking they want to see buildings open later on campus and businesses open later. So that was the first part. So yeah, how would you plan on or would you plan on having libraries and spaces open later on campus? Do you want to start, Roger?
Yes. The other night I was here, just as like came up the other night, I was here for the there was an event at the Pit. I was here until around 11 o'clock. Nobody hardly showed up there. And I waited and waited for this event to start, because it was supposed to meet the students, like a meet and greet. Nobody showed up. So after that, I decided to leave. And then when I was leaving, I noticed that this this confectionery down here was closed. I was going to buy a chocolate bar for my trip home. And I asked the people, I said, is there anywhere to buy anything here, like for a snack? He said, no, everything's closed. I said, what? And so when on the way home, I noticed that the only places were open McDonald's and other places way down there, and then Safeway off campus. And I realized there are students here that stay up all night, they're studying. And what if they get snacks? There's nothing here to go, where to go. Like, they'd have to go for a long walk or wait for the morning bus just to go get a snack. And that's crazy. Like, you're harming those students.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Miriam?
Yeah, so but in my platform, I talk about actually opening the nest up 24/7 during the exam season, because that's something I totally see that students would be frustrated about. If nest is supposed to be the place that is supposed to be the home for the student body, then we really need to do a better job of actually making that space accessible and open all the time. I also heard some in the question talking about just having more events, and I completely understand that we have this amazing place. We have the gallery, we have the Pit, but we don't really use them all that much, right? So more programming over there. We had drag night last night, and it's such an amazing event. What if we could make every single night that was something amazing like that? And I would be all for it to make sure that we do something along those lines.
Yeah, what do you have any ideas of, like, what specific events you would want to have, or
So, for example, we were thinking, I work with WISE, which is a harm reduction campaign on service on campus. And one thing we have been playing around with the idea was having a trivia night was for harm reduction. So we know students are having fun on this campus. We know that they want that campus life. But the longer we actually not talk about the fact that students are engaging in substances, that they're having different experiences on this campus, we will actually just negate their experiences and not talk about them, right? So what if while having fun, we could be talking about ways we can be having fun more safely? So whether it's a trivia night or a naloxone training party, how cool would that be if the naloxone training party wasn't done with the somber idea of, oh my God, this is happening, but rather, hey, this is happening. How do we become active agents of actually solving this problem? Get some pizza in and then start the naloxone party. I think that would be a great way for us to actually finally start breaking the ice regarding matters that are important, but also ones that can be dealt with a little bit more fun and a little bit more importance from the rest of the community.
Thank you. So, Andy, how would you plan on making buildings stay open later on campus?
I would do whatever the AMS would be able to do, right? Like, the AMS only has a certain amount of power, like, opening certain buildings, because AMS doesn't control everything. And so I remember one time I was in computer science, and I stayed up until 12 o'clock trying to finish an assignment with my partner on campus, and that was not a fun experience. And Ronnie's right, there sometimes some of the services, they aren't open at night, and I think it would be a good opportunity to open some of the services, because students need that type of opportunity to work and to do what they want.
Thank you. Rodney, do you want to address events on campus?
Events, okay. Excuse me, sorry. Is this close enough?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Good.
Okay, so events. Let's see. There's a lot of events that could be done in honor of the Two Spirits and LGBT community. Have drag shows out here. They're a lot of fun downtown when I used to go to them. Other events could be meet and greet. Okay, here's another event. You could have a lecture. There's about almost over 600 nations here in Canada, First Nations. Why not have a speaker, not a speaker from each one, but an information session about each one. So people here from other countries, they can come and learn about First Nations in Canada or Indigenous communities here in Canada. And I know I'm pushing a lot of Indigenous issues in this election, but it's been 100 years and there's hardly anything here within the AMS that addresses Indigenous issues. Mm. And that's why it's so important to me. So maybe we can have beading, like women come in, elders come in, they teach the students how to bead moccasins. They can make jackets like you saw my mom made. Hi, mommy, she's listening.
And, so are my parents.
So anyway, for them to come in and help to show how to make jackets like the one you guys saw, things like that, to show arts and crafts, like the students will be made to feel at home. To give them a sense of like they're not only are they doing something with their education, but understanding who we are as First Nations. I think that's really important.
Okay, thank you. And Andy, do you want to address the question of increased and improved events on campus? How would you improve event life on campus?
I think that would be delegated down to one of the other VPs, I think, regarding like addressing specific events or including certain clubs into the AMS clubhouse. But I do think inclusion is important because we want to hear all the different voices. Like for my campaign, I feel like we haven't been addressing interfaith dialogues enough. And I feel like we need to have that kind of inclusion. Personally, for me, I'm a Christian, so I want to hear that Christian voice on campus, right? So that's me.
Thank you. So this is the next question that we got from a student.
Is there anything that you're kind of, like, not content with on campus, or...
I don't really know what the AMS does.
I don't really spend a whole lot of time.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a need to have kind of, like, greater transparency about what the AMS actually does?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's something that we've heard kind of a lot among people. Like,
I don't even really know what the AMS is. I just know it hosts events.
Yeah.
I don't know who the AMS is, though.
Yeah, so not really a question, but one thing Sadie and I got a lot of was, like, we don't really even know what the AMS does. So how would you plan on increasing awareness of what the AMS does and transparency of, what the AMS is working on? Do you want to go first, Andy?
Yeah, sure. So the AMS, I'm pretty sure it represents the student voice. That's what the AMS does, and it's here to help students have a good time and have a good experience of life on campus. And so the way I want to address that is I want to give them the gospel, because I believe that through the gospel, a lot of the issues on campus, like say, for example, discrimination or sexual assault, these are important issues. And I believe with the gospel, people will become better people. So that's how I want to address issues. And that's how I want to engage students on campus.
Thank you. Miriam, do you want to?
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, if you're a student who's wondering what the AMS is, I hear you. If I hadn't joined the AMS almost a year and a half ago, I wouldn't know anything about the AMS myself, right? So I think it comes down to the fact that not only are we not telling students what we do, it's also the fact that we're not even telling them why it's important for them to know about this, right? So if there is a lot of money that goes into keeping this place, and the money is coming from students, but how many students actually get to know what exactly where these fees are going from? So it's about first informing students regarding what happens to that money and why that matters. Whether there's always something within the AMS that they can be using, whether it is the food outlets, whether it is AMS tutoring, or whether it is the AMS health and dental plan. How many of us have traveled during spring break or wanted to travel and thought, do I need insurance or not? Guess what? Your AMS should be covering that, but we don't know all of that. So I think it starts from making sure that every single thing that the AMS offers and what students can get out of it, it should be simple and honest for us to know. And if there are things that students want for the AMS to give to them, it should also be equally easy for students to come up and say, hey, I realize that this is something that I want from the AMS and it hasn't been there. How do I go about telling that to the elected membership that this is what I want? And I think it goes both ways, right? So it has to be not only us informing students through better outreach on social media, better outreach just on campus and visibility on campus. We know that there is an AMS office upstairs, but we don't know who sits in there. Who are these people behind these places? So I think making sure people know who these people are, where to reach them, how can they reach them. And also for people who don't want to come and personally talk to us, there should also be different ways that we're engaging with them, whether it's Reddit, whether it's through CITR or the UBC, or just being there on like campus events and letting them know, hey, it's us. If you guys want to say something, we are here to listen to you.
Thank you. And Rodney.
There are over 300 clubs here at UBC, are there? Why not have like the person who's responsible for the clubs or the president or whoever, like from the Board of Governors, come and talk to them, give information sessions to each one. Like, let's say you have about 300, you have about four different info sessions with the different clubs. You have them come in as a group, different groups, and you talk with them, and you ask them first they would ask their members questions like, what do you want to hear from your AMS? The person that's giving the workshop, let's say it's one of us here, we would go there and we would explain to what the AMS is here for and what we do and who we are, like each one of us, and inform them. If you want to ask questions, our offices are open upstairs. Come and talk to us. Like for me, I believe that an open door policy. I've seen many politicians over the years, their doors are closed, and they go through my secretary or go through my assistant to make an appointment. That's kind of crazy, though. I find it crazy. And so I would have people like just come up and talk to me and discuss your issues, like one to one or in a forum setting.
If I can add something to that, AMS does have clubs orientation, and I think that's one of the other things, right? It's not about just having clubs orientation, because I can guarantee you there is a student out there who's not part of any club, and who actually does not even feel the sense of belonging yet to be part of a club. And it's about also reaching out to those students, making sure that it's not just people who are already engaged that are being engaged in this conversation, but also the ones who are in first year and are wondering, what is it that the AMS does? Who is AMS? What is AMS, right? For them to also get that information. So I think it's not just about integrating them into existing places, but also making sure that areas that we have never thought of before are also being looked into.
Okay. Well, then something's failing, because these questions keep coming up then. And today when I was walking here, I noticed there are some students, I was walking along where all those dormitories are, like on the south side. The way the look on their faces, like... it seemed like they were lost. It seemed like they wanted to reach out to somebody, but they didn't know who to do it, like who to contact. And that's what was on my mind today when I saw those students. Like I kind of felt sad for them. They're standing there by the window all by themselves, and they're texting. I don't know what they were doing. Probably texting somebody back at home, but it did seem like they felt lost in where they were. It just seemed like they didn't know what to do.
I'd also like to add to that as well. Yeah, I agree. Like many times on campus, you'll just see people, they're just like sitting there, like they don't know what they're doing. They're like on their phone or they're on their computer, but they like people will often be frowning. Maybe it's like natural, but usually people, they won't be engaging with the culture, right? And we want to engage students with the culture. Personally, I believe that through the gospel, that would be the best way to do it, because because the gospel, it promotes love, it promotes community. And that's what we want to see for students. We want to give them a purpose in life, and I believe the gospel can do that.
So when we were out on our streeter, and kind of what I've been getting from a lot of my friends is they're not planning on voting, or they were only planning on voting once they talked to us, and they realize that this is happening. So what are you doing to address voter apathy, and how are you like getting out there and engaging and increasing awareness about something that students don't really seem to know is happening?
Andy, do you want to go first?
Okay. So addressing voter apathy, that's exactly why I ran with the platform I did. I believe that the gospel, it's a contentious issue. Like you've seen I believe like a lot of people have seen the social media comments about me, and I want to engage students, but through contention, I believe that students, they'll like spread the word more. And I believe that student apathy will be less, but ultimately I still love them. It's okay that they're like not happy with who I am, but it's fine because I want students to be engaged. And yeah.
Have you been receiving a lot of negativity around your campaign?
I mean, people have been critical, but just critical about certain parts of my campaign. I think that's a good thing, because that sharpens my campaign to make it more professional, I think. So it's good in a way.
Yeah. Okay. Rodney, do you want to answer next?
Okay. I want to address two things here. The first question you talked about was getting out there and talking to students. And I think one of the things the students got to realize, there's different ages that come to this university. And when I approached some of them today, I'm happy. Like I walk along and say, hi, how are you doing? And they sit there and they just sort of cower. And I said, oh, no. I'm not here to hurt you. I'm not here to do anything like that. I'm running for president here with the AMS, and I'm sharing this with you. This is who I am. If you want to get to know me, look on Facebook. Here's my name Look me up, and I'll friend you if you want. But if you go through everything, you'll know who I am. Secondly, talking about Andy here last night, what I was really, I wanted to apologize for like any disrespect I showed you last night. And one of the things too is like, you are, how did you say your name again? I'm sorry.
Miriam Hammond.
Yeah. I was kind of upset because you are right now in a position of power within the AMS. You hold a seat up there. When those students were laughing last night, it's like you could have stopped them from laughing at him, like giggling at him when he was talking, and you didn't. You let it occur. At times I saw that you're sitting on a fence. You don't want to make a decision, yes or no, but you have to make that decision. Later on in your career, you're going to have to make a decision, and some people may not like your decision, but you have. For me, I've seen it done in politicians over the years. They don't make decisions. They sit on that fence, and then later on, they're blasted for that decision they make. And I felt bad for you last night, and I apologize for that, and I hope you understand, but I'm First Nations. To me, God is the land. The land, is the creator, and that's why important to me, okay?
Can I respond to that?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that, but I've already forgiven those people. Like, I kind of expected that going into this election, and I'm a believer in Jesus, right? And what Jesus did when he was on earth was he forgave the people that persecuted him before they even said sorry. And that's who I am. I'm okay with them mocking me and laughing at me, but I just want to give them the gospel because I love them. And yeah.
Miriam, did you want to respond to Rodney's comments?
Or? Absolutely. You mentioned the fact that I sat there. Have you wondered that when questions were being asked about these things that have also affected me as a woman, and in moments where you guys were allowed to speak before I was, that in itself could have been something that could have affected me? I was not there staying silent because I was letting him, I was letting those people laugh at him. I was trying to keep my own composure regarding a lot of the things that were happening. Moments where Andy has said that he just wants to have interfaith dialogue and that he just wants to promote gospel. As somebody who has struggled and somebody who still struggles to tell to the world that I am a woman who identifies as being Muslim, it is difficult for me to even come to terms with that in an open space. So for me to, for you to put the onus of responsibility just to me is also like you expecting that I am responsible for every single thing that happens on campus. As somebody who has fought for students and who continues to do that, whether from the first 6 months I was at UBC or from being here right now and fighting for people's access to services, you singling me out and saying that the entire onus falls on me is also something that you think you should consider can also hurt me. And I know it is not your intention, but something else you should consider. I think we'd like to go back to the question that you asked, because apathy, I think that's what we're here ultimately for apathy. When I first told a friend that I'm running for AMS president, that friend asked me, despite being somebody clearly involved, why do I care? And I heard them. I really do. And it's because I can guarantee that there is some point and there is some intersection within your life at UBC where AMS will be able to help you. And that's what I'm running for. There is one place, whether you got that grade that you don't want and you think your professor is not treating you well, you can come to the AMS for it. Whether you actually just want a coffee and you want to come to the AMS for it, you can do all of those things. So that's why you should be caring. Somebody close to me, somebody who works in harm reduction, told me, you have to meet people where they're at, not where you want them to be. And I think that is basically what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to meet people where they're at. And that includes people who still don't know what the AMS is and making sure going forward, we listen to those voices.
Thank you. So last off with our discussion with these candidates here, we wanted to ask you about policy 131, which is the sexual assault policy here at UBC. So it's been discussed a lot this year. So are you planning on making any changes to it? And what are your thoughts on the current policy? So Rodney, do you want to start off?
Okay. 2 years ago, when I think it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago, it came across the table at the that Unicron committee, and I thought everything was done at that table. I thought like everything was ready to go. I said, okay, this is all right. As a person who suffered like abuse, and I understand that this, I thought it was done. I really thought it was done at that time. So we could carry on like people waiting without having to wait for question or waiting for action from people in charge. I thought we would be taking care of that. But then all of a sudden it changed over the years, like wording gets changed, actions need to be changed. But then a few years ago when I first started here, I heard the president say the best of the best are here. Well, the best of the best are not agreeing with each other. The best of the best should be have agreed the very first day that it came out. And then that policy would have been taking place right then and there.
Thank you. Yeah. Miriam, do you want to go next? Mm-hmm.
Definitely. In the past year that I have been in my position, I see survivors go through the process of getting the accommodation that they need. It should not be that this difficult for them. If you're a survivor and you want to not disclose to people and just get have a withdrawal out of a course, if you're living on residence and you just want somebody to listen to you, but not for that to become a bureaucratic web that you have to navigate through, all of those things should not be happening, but they are currently happening right now. It's because UBC has not aligned the values that they had in Policy 131 to the operations that they have. And I think that's a big, it's something that they don't realize the magnitude of how many people it is affecting currently. There are people who we are failing. There are people that UBC has failed to realize the effects of them not doing something as easy and operational as just saying that what we laid out in a policy needs to finally happen. And that goes from the staff that they have throughout the university, that goes to the academic accommodations a survivor might seek out when they want to withdraw from a course and not go through the trauma of still being in that course. But we don't make those easy for them. UBC does not do the greatest job of making sure that those people are being heard and that we are not elongating a process that's already been really difficult for them. If elected, I want to make sure that a survivor does not have to go out of their way to get what they should be getting out of the system. And that's what I hope that I am able to do as I embark on a journey if elected.
Thank you. And Andy, do you want to?
Marion, could you just confirm? Mm-hmm. Policy 131 is dealt with by the Senate, right? So
Policy 131 is not dealt by the Senate. Policy 131 is a university-wide policy, which has implications in every single realm of the university. Senate is one of them, but not even entirely. This is the first time we have realized that there are aspects of Senate that coincide with it but haven't been adjusted.
I see. Okay, yeah. No, I totally agree with Miriam. Like, survivors need to have that access. Like, I've never been sexually assaulted myself, so I don't know the feeling. I can never be able to empathize with them. It's just not possible. And I agree, like, this is a big issue that we need to be able to have that availability for survivors. But and this also saddens my heart because the very fact that we have to deal with these issues, that's very sad. And I do believe that the answer is through the gospel. And I do hope to preach it because the gospel, it's about loving one another more than yourselves. It's about treating each other with respect. And I do hope to see that at UBC.
Okay, so thank you all for your answers to all of the questions. We're going to move on to the second portion of our show, but maybe really quickly, if you guys want to let listeners know where they can find more information about your platform. So Andy, do you have a Facebook page or anything like that?
Yeah, my Facebook tag is ANDYLIN1997. Yeah, that's ANDYLIN1997. And you can also go to my website, ANDYALLIN.com.
Thank you. And Rodney, where can people find
you? You can always find, like, just search me at Rodney Little Mustache and then find me on Facebook and friend me if you want, and I'll ask you your questions, especially about a lot of things that happened tonight.
Thank you. And Miriam?
If you guys want to know more, I have a Facebook page that says Vote Miriam. And if you guys would like to, you will find a lot of information there. But if you want a full platform, go to votemiriam.com. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. And yeah, up next, we're going to be joined by Max Holmes, VP Academic. He's in studio. He's waiting. So yeah, thank you.
Do you want to know more about human rights abuses, global issues, and international politics? Are you interested in writing to foreign and local governments in response to global crises? Are you ready to give peace a chance? If your answer is yes, then Amnesty International UBC may be the club for you. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/AIUBC or send us an email at amnestyubc@gmail.com. Give peace a chance.
GLSA, the Global Outreach Students Association, offers students the chance to learn about global health and international development while providing students with opportunities for practical experience working within disadvantaged communities both locally and internationally. They also collaborate with other clubs to organize global health-related symposiums and competitions. Executive positions are available. Contact them at ubc.gosa@gmail.com.
I'm going away. Look into my eyes. The last Sunday of every month from 11 to 5. Won't you hear with me?
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Okay, so we're back on UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, and we're broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory here at UBC, and we're talking about AMS elections. So we just had the three AMS presidential candidates on the show, Rodney Little Mustache, Miriam Hamid, and Andy Lin, and they did a Q&A, and this episode is going to be podcasted online at citr.ca if you missed it and you want to hear their answers. And the UBC has also done a lot of coverage, so yeah, you can head to the UBC's page if you want more info on the candidates, and it's also available online on the AMS's website. So now we're joined by Max Holmes. Hi, Max.
Hi, thanks for having me, Alex.
Thank you. So why don't you introduce yourself and your position at the AMS?
Yeah, so right now I'm the current AMS VP Academic and University Affairs, and I'm running for re-election as the incumbent, as well as I'm a student senator at large and also running again for re-election to that position too.
Yeah, and we should probably say that you're running uncontested, so
yes.
you have no opponent. Yeah.
No. Yeah.
So like my money is on you winning.
I think that's a good bet.
Yeah. Cool. So you're joining us on the show because you published a letter in the UBC, and you've published a few letters in the mm-hmm. UBC, because I understand that you used to write for them in your first year. Yeah. So you published a few letters in the UBC. So do you want to kind of talk about the letter that was just published yesterday?
Yeah. So I went to the endorsement meeting for the Interfraternity Council, and they had an all presidents meeting. And I got to present my platform just like every other candidate. And one of the first things I was asked about was my platform point around survivor-centric sexual assault support. And at first, it seemed to be a question to want to know more. And then I slowly realized that the opinions in the room did not agree with the opinions that were in my platform. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the letter, is because I felt that I didn't really want to accept an endorsement from an organization that represented the values that they did when they asked the questions and made the offhand comments that they did.
Yeah. So what were some of those comments?
Yeah. So a few of the things I was asked about was, one, someone brought up false accusations when we were talking about survivor-centric sexual assault support. And one of the things I informed them of was that most literature says around 95-97% of reports are true and very few are false allegations. And survivor-centric also, they thought that would assume guilt. And rather, I said that survivor-centric has nothing to do with the accused. That's why it's called survivor-centric. And that rather it has to do with the trauma that the survivor has experienced and believing the survivor when they say that they experienced that trauma. One of the additional scenarios that was put to me, which was probably one of the most, just outrageous things I've heard, was that there was an assault within a fraternity, or there was someone accused of assault. And what happened was that member still lived in their house, and the person asked me, do I feel that we should be offering housing accommodations to the accused from the AMS? And I informed them that the AMS doesn't own any housing, so we don't have accommodations to offer.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, like in the bathroom of the nest.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah.
And,
a place to have them.
Exactly. And then, like, I went on to just kind of, you know, talk to them. And, like, you know, this thing that they seemed to worry about was that it wasn't about, you know, the safety of anyone, but rather that girls felt uncomfortable going to their house parties. And I thought that should not be high on the priority list when we're talking about survivor-centric sexual assault support.
Mm, wow. Have you received any, like, comments from the IFC following your letter? Anything?
Yeah, so the IFC released a statement, you know, obviously, I disagree with part of their statement, but of course, they're coming from their personal experience, just like I came from my personal experience. And I have actually been reached out to by some of the vice presidents that were in the room, as well as I've spoken to presidents of fraternities. And most of them have come out with overwhelming support for the letter that I published, which was something that I was really surprised about, because I was very worried that when I came out with this letter, I wasn't going to receive support from the community. And I think, you know, the one thing that this shows is that this isn't representative of the Greek community at large, but rather a small minority that have managed to get into leadership positions.
Mm. And so by not accepting the endorsement from the IFC, what kind of implications would that have for the AMS, if that's something?
Yeah, so, you know, the AMS's relationship with fraternities is a little odd in that fraternities aren't really subsidiaries of the AMS like many clubs are, but the Interfraternity Council actually is a club of the AMS. So it doesn't have many implications on the AMS, because one of the things that I really just made sure in my letter was that I wasn't representing the opinion of the AMS, but rather the experience that I had in that room. And that, you know, the AMS will still try to continue to have, I think, a cooperative relationship with the fraternities. And one of the things I've actually spoken to their spoken to a few leaders in their community about is that I think that fraternities should be working with the AMS to be looking at their own investigative procedures, just like we're reviewing ours right now.
The internal AMS procedure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Since this has happened, there's been, like, but it made a big impact. A number of other candidates running have done the same thing that you've done. And it's kind of became a little bit of a contentious thing. I think a lot of people are with you, but it's a bit of a talk. Did you realize how this would, like, big this would go? Because I understand it was a bit, usually you want the endorsement of the IFC. Did you realize, like, that how big an impact this would make?
The way that I kind of put it to someone is that I thought that it might cause, you know, waves or ripples, not tsunamis. And so that's kind of what I've told people. I had no idea that when I came out about this that, you know, not even within a day, the majority of candidates that received an endorsement from the IFC would reject their endorsement from the IFC, and that now 6 out of 8 candidates have done that as well. I really wanted it to be about my own, you know, personal experience that I had within that room, and that, you know, as a survivor, I felt uncomfortable in the position that I was put in. And, you know, it's really amazing to see the support that I've gotten from within the Greek community and also from my fellow candidates, as well as, you know, one of the things, you know, that I'm just impressed by is that, you know, just so many people are now talking about this issue during the election, which is so important.
Yeah, I think it's definitely brought up a lot of discussion points. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was also really surprised, but, like, maybe impressed that the other candidates were also following your lead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it speaks volumes about the culture that we're living in on campus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and following the meeting with the IFC, how did you come to the decision to reject their endorsement? Was that, like, an immediate decision that was quite clear, or did you have to think about it, and what was on your mind?
Yeah, so when I left the room, there were the Senate candidates were waiting to go in to talk about their endorsements, and I think you can ask a few of them. I was pretty upset when I left the room, saying that I'm pretty sure I said that's the worst meeting I've had in a long time. And so I was visibly upset when I left the room. And, you know, the first thing that I was talking to people about was, I don't know if I can accept the endorsement of this group. And one of the first things I thought was, I don't even think that they would give me their endorsement after they expressed the opinions that they did in that room. And I was surprised to get their endorsement. I guess it was probably a difficult decision for them, seeming as there was no alternative candidate. And so, you know, one of the things I did was, you know, when I got that message from the IFC president saying that I got the endorsement, the first thing I started doing was writing my letter to reject the endorsement and sent a quick message over to the UBC to let them know that I was sending them a letter. And then it was published the very next day.
Wow. Are there any suggestions you have for the fraternities in order for them to improve the culture surrounding these issues?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that I've been very impressed by is that they're starting to have these conversations a lot more. And I've told people, a few of the people that have contacted me, and they've said that they're shocked that, you know, they're discussing this issue now because they weren't someone that used to discuss this issue. And I think one of the best things that they can do is one of the things that we have going on in the AMS right now is our sexual violence prevention and respectful environment policy working group, which I am currently the chair of. And I would hope that the fraternities would look into whether they want to opt into the policies that we create from that working group. Because one of the things we've noticed in the AMS is that we want experts doing investigations. We want people who are qualified to be doing the investigations. We don't think that students should be doing investigations. We think that students should have proper support. And that's something that we're looking at with our policies. And I think that that's something that the fraternities should really review and perhaps they should look to become a part of. Because I often think that the internal structures that organizations, you know, like the Greek community have are not the best way of dealing with investigations.
Mm-hmm. And I also noticed in your letter, like right at the beginning, you say, you know, this isn't representative of all people in fraternities or sororities or Greek life. It's the leadership. So, yeah, I just wanted to kind of like reiterate that you made that point because it's not about like individuals within the like fraternities in general, but like about the leadership and the people or the comments that you heard at the meetings.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things I was most impressed by was that I would say I got around like 30 messages on the first day that I like made my post, and people reaching out to me being like, I'm an alum of the Greek community, or I'm a current member of the Greek community, and like I do not stand by the things that were said in that room. And it just really shows that so many people don't agree with the values that were expressed by the questions that were asked and the offhand comments that were made.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone else have any final questions? Yeah.
This is a little bit, maybe it's on topic, but kind of not about the rejection of the endorsement, but actually about the working group that you just talked about. I was just wondering, because there's a lot of talk that you say there's focusing on what kind of investigations that are going to happen against survivors. But I'm just wondering, because these events happen quite often, and it seems to me that the reason why these kinds of events happen is because of a type of culture that is being created within, for example, a competitive society or in a place where people are very sexually frustrated. And like, I'm not saying that the people who commit these crimes are to be forgiven, but rather, how do we stop that from being acceptable? And are those issues also being acknowledged in those work groups?
Yeah, so one of the things that we made sure of on the working group that we have is that it's a small, compact group, but that SASC has a very large presence on that working group. And so one of the things that we've discussed is that what's important to this group is that it's not only response, but that it's also prevention. And so one of the things that we're looking at is, what more can we be doing for club training? What more can we be doing to make sure that the fraternities are actually implementing the required SASC training that they should be doing? And also looking at, you know, conversations that we can have as a broader community. Because I think one of the things that I've realized in this conversation is I feel that there were so many people within this community that, you know, weren't necessarily having these discussions, or the discussions weren't happening publicly. And I think one of the best things that we can do is bring this issue to the forefront so that we're trying to have these discussions in a public dialogue, and so that we can really talk about the issues that are being caused, because it's something that is not going away. And what someone noticed the other day was, you know, I was talking about this issue and, you know, someone laughed for a second. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about is that this is becoming something that's getting desensitized. This is an issue that has been around for so long and, you know, has happened to so many people that we're becoming, you know, kind of numb to hearing sexual assault on the news. And so one of the things that I hope is that we can have these public conversations and that we can really, you know, heavily analyze what we're doing so that we can, you know, make sure that we have survivor-centric approaches, but that we're also looking at approaches to make sure that we're preventing this from happening.
Yeah, so in terms of policy 131, are there changes that you think should be made to that policy or greater implementation? Or
yeah, so I think one of the things I'll say is that policy 131 has had probably the worst implementation of any policy in a long time. UBC really hasn't taken it seriously, and they've shown that if not for the province forcing them to make policy 131, they probably wouldn't have made a sexual assault policy to begin with. And so one of the things that I hope that we can look at is, for example, within the policy, something that's brought up is third-party allegations instead of third-party reporting, trying to make it sound like for some reason, you know, if something comes from a third party, it's less true, which, of course, that's just false. And so one of the things that we should be looking at is robust third-party reporting rules, as well as something else we can be looking at that other universities have, is making sure that we have free opt-in responding to disclosure training for all community members. Something else that I've really noticed is that there's this perpetual referral loop at UBC within faculties and within systems where you know, people go and they talk to a faculty member, and a faculty member doesn't even know what policy 131 is. And so they tell their department head about the disclosure that they got. And then their department head goes to the associate dean, and already you have multiple violations of the sexual assault policy there. And I've had conversations, you know, with people within Senate that, you know, just make completely false points saying that, you know, for example, only 80% of allegations are true, which is just, you know, not the statistics. And so I think one of the things that we can be doing at UBC is more education, as well as looking at a lot of our academic policies. And one of the most disappointing things that I saw was that in our new strategic plan, we didn't mention sexual violence at all. You know, we talked about so many systematic abuses, and of course, we talk about all the wonderful things we're doing for student well-being and the student experience, but we don't talk about one of the things that our institution has really been very complicit in, and that's been the issue of sexual violence. And it had to take, you know, student senators publicly asking for the university leadership to put that in the strategic plan at the very meeting it was being endorsed at. And so it's just really disappointing to see that, you know, people aren't caring about the implementation of this policy. And so, you know, one of the things I think that we can do is make sure that we're speaking up more publicly and that we're saying that, you know, we're really disappointed with where we are right now, and going back and reviewing that policy and trying to give more power to the groups that have to enforce it.
Yeah, and what role does the AMS play in the implementation of that policy?
Yeah, so one of the roles that I play is I sit on the Sexual Violence Advisory Committee, which has met once since the creation of Policy 131. And, you know, it's really disappointing for me as a student leader to see that this isn't something that people are meeting about more. You know, one of the things, one of the ideas that I was told about that I think is amazing is to have a Survivor Advisory Committee, to have actual people that self-identify as survivors to really tell the university, you know, what needs to happen. And most of these groups that are meeting, you know, just have no power to actually implement this policy. And one of the things that we've seen from an academic perspective is that there really isn't a want or, you know, a need from, you know, some faculty's perspectives to implement this policy. And if you even look at the case-by-case basis, people make different decisions depending on where you go. And I think what we need to be looking at is we need to be looking at all of our structures, and we need to be looking locally and on an institutional level at what we can do. And I think the one thing that the AMS is going to do is that this year in our academic experience survey, we included questions around sexual assault and other misconduct, because we really want to have a benchmark for the university and be like, you're doing a horrible job right now and you need to improve. And so I'm hopeful that with the collection of that data, presenting it to both the Senate and the Board of Governors once we have it, that we can really just show that the university needs to be doing more, because I think students understand that that needs to happen. And I think it's the job of the university to understand that now.
Yeah, because in our interview about Textbook Broke, which is obviously a completely different campaign, but about affordability for textbooks and course materials, yeah, you mentioned the academic experience survey.
Yeah.
And then I went and did it. And yeah, I saw these questions, but and like, it's so important that the school has data on this.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And I think it's important for students to be engaged. And that's something like that's come up a lot in our discussions on the elections is student engagement. And so, yeah, these surveys are out there and you can do it. Where can students find the survey?
Yeah. So if you just go to our Facebook page, you can find it there, as well as you if you vote in the AMS elections. It's going to be on all of the email blasts, the link, as well as it's going to be on the ballot itself. And we'll be sending out an email blast actually this afternoon, I think.
I just got it.
There you go. And we'll also be sending out one final email blast, not this coming Monday, but the next Monday, for the final day for people to fill out that survey. And the more people that fill that survey out, the more legitimate the data is. And we use a professional company to do most of the analysis of the data. So it's something that the university really looks at and they can't refute.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Okay. So, yeah, that's the end of the show. But, Max, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you also for sharing, you know, your personal stories. And I think that it's been so impactful and started a really important discussion on campus.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, next week we're going to be talking more about AMS elections because next Friday is the last day to vote in the elections. So, yeah, we're going to be talking about voter apathy and maybe improvements the AMS could do around the elections because, yeah, we've definitely got some comments from students about how the election process could be improved. So, yeah, more of a meta-analysis next week. But reminder, just go and vote, people. It's fun. I don't know if it's
fun. It's as easy as one click.
It is as easy as one click.
And always be lucky that you have the right to vote and always take that opportunity to vote.
Yeah, even if it seems silly, it's AMS controls a lot more than you think, and you should be involved. And you should also take the survey, because the survey is important.
big data.
Yeah, big data. Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, thank you to the presidential candidates who are on the show, and Max again. So, yeah, up next is Radio Pizza Party. I don't know. They're going to be having fun. So, yeah, thank you all for joining us, and we'll hear from you next week.
Considering a master's, MBA, or doctoral degree? Then mark Sunday, February 25th in your calendar and get over to the Vancouver Convention Center East Building for the Study and Go Abroad Fair. The best part? Admission is free. Check online at www.studyandgoabroad.com for more information.
What changes would you like to see on UBC's campus?
Like libraries staying open for longer. And like,
okay.
And like stores and stuff staying open for longer. Yeah. I feel like they shut too early. And they're actually closing the weekends as well. So.
Oh, and more like fun events. Like how in Jomstar, like AMS had like stuff every week. So like maybe something like now, they have like something like fun every week, I guess. Mm. Yeah.
Are you looking for your next step in education or to travel? Learn about undergraduate and postgraduate programs, professional degrees and doctorates, as well as work abroad, language, travel, and internships at the Study and Go Abroad Fair on February 25th at the Vancouver Convention Center. Admission is free, so check out www.studyandgoabroad.com for more information.
Do you have any questions for any of the specific candidates?
Well, I mean, like, how are you gonna get more people involved? Because, like, at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's like, you know, cool, the Washington Post democracy dies in the dark. You know, like, people aren't gonna vote if they're like, they feel like there's nothing for them in it, and like, that's why people feel like they're in the dark about things. Because, like, speaking for myself, like, I care because I care, not because like it does anything for me. Like I like it's my principle to care. But the people that don't have that, like you're probably not doing much for them. You're not speaking to them. So like just as much as you want them to connect with you, you need to try to connect with them, and like that would help.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really